Backseat Book Club, interview number 2, Matthew Woodring Stover.
I am the only backseat producer for the night because this is a Backseat Book Club special interview episode, this time with Mr. Matthew Stover. Say hello.
Hi, Scott. Very happy to be here. I caught your podcast last week and was very flattered. I enjoyed it quite a bit.
Well, I enjoyed recording that one. I was very glad to do it. Unfortunately, my cohorts from that episode could not make it out. Dirk is, I think, somewhere in Alberta right now doing theatery things.
I bet he's cold.
Well, he sent me pictures. There's already snow on the ground over that way.
Well, and we're getting snow here, and I'm in central Illinois, which is a long way south of Alberta.
That is very south of Alberta, and I think Chris was just busy with something else, but that they're with us in spirit, I'm sure.
Great.
That's great. And we are going to talk a little about your novel Heroes Die, which I mean I just reread it last month, but this is like 15 years old or more for you.
Yes.
Is it weird to have someone have people still talking about this book when there's been other stuff since, or is it just kind of fun for you to hear?
It's very fun for me to hear. It's kind of an unusual thing, because one of the things that struck me when I was listening to your podcast was how, maybe just due to its relative age, you know, as you said, it's been in print for 15 years. It seems like people take it more seriously now than they did when it came out. And, you know, because it's, I guess, after a book has been around for a little while, people hear about it and they start thinking, well, there must be something more there. If you go back and look at the original reviews that Heroes Die got from Kirkus and Publishers Weekly, you would find a definite lack of comprehension as to what was actually going on. They were all kind of astonished, because I guess because it was coming from Del Rey, they were astonished that it was not, that I was not David Eddings or Terry Brooks. So it's been an interesting process watching the sort of evolution in Kane's reputation from 1998 till today. You know, the fourth book was just published in 2012.
I guess stepping back 15 years ago, which came first, Overworld or Kane?
Well, they came more or less together. Kane was always intended to be a sort of, well, as I guess Scott Lynch once described him, as a fantasy Batman. He was always intended to be a sort of performance art piece, a villain that you sympathize with because you identify with his goals. And I was, back in those days, really, really into role-playing games. As well as I was trained as an actor. I was actually in college and getting a classical education as a Shakespearean actor when I came up with this concept that eventually became the Acts of Cain. So what I was really going for was trying to do, I wanted to write something that would evoke the experience of playing in a really, really engaging role-playing game, but also look a little bit at the sort of messier implications of that people don't really think about when they're player characters, if you see what I'm saying.
Yeah, no, most of the time you don't. And I don't want to get into too much of a gaming story myself, but during the playtest for the upcoming Dreamhounds of Paris adventure for Trail of Cthulhu, I would say about 60% of our game was actually us just sitting around discussing the implications of what we were doing. Because that's what you do when you're surrealist painters running around Lovecraft's dreamlands.
Right.
I guess.
Right. That makes perfect sense.
Yeah, it does make perfect sense.
I'd actually like to play painter. That.
Well, I mean, it's a fun game. And if you don't have a group where you can point to one guy and say, he has to play Dali, you don't have a good enough gaming.
Right. Right, I'm hip.
Yeah, but...
more of a Magritte guy myself, but... Hey.
Well, we did have a Magritte also.
Oh, good.
We had a Dali, a Magritte, a Brunel, a Man Ray, and I played Dekiriko.
That just sounds hilarious.
It was. It's a very different sort of game.
I believe it.
There's a few things in that I want to visit, but so you were training as an actor. How much of that plays into sort of the Harry Kane dichotomy?
Well, there is a lot of... Well, I think you or one of the other guys brought up in your podcast the other night, a lot of the sort of dramatic tension in the book is the tension between Harry, the actor, and Kane, the character. Because, you know, there is a sense in which Kane, even though he is an invented character, he's fictional, he's more real than Harry is. He's certainly more powerful, but he can't. I could ramble on at some length on this subject. Maybe I won't. Let's just say that actors enter into a very intimate relationship with the characters they create. It's not anything as cliched as confusing their reality for your reality. It doesn't work that way. It is more it's a function of playing a character has a lot to do with training yourself to see situations through the character's eyes and through the lens of their experience rather than through your own eyes and your own experience. And it does change you. And it certainly changes Harry, transforms his entire life.
Okay, and so with the setting, was it always sort of this sci-fi fantasy hybrid, or did that sort of slowly come together as the book was finished?
It was always a sci-fi fantasy hybrid, intentionally. I wanted a science fictional representation to sort of ground the grimmer aspects of the fantasy side. In you have to remember that when I was writing this, you know, the top selling fantasy writers in the world were David and Lee Eddings and Bob Salvatore and, you know, Terry Brooks and you know, guys. I mean, Bob Salvatore was a little bit dark for the fantasy genre in those days.
Which is just interesting to think about.
It is amazing to think about, but true.
Like how far we have fallen and how sort of squeaky clean Bob Salvatore's characters have gotten.
Well, yeah, but you know, you go back and look, I mean, a lot of what people liked about Drizzt was that he wasn't Luke Skywalker. You know, Drizzt is a guy who always has to be aware of his, you'll excuse the phrase since I just brought up Luke Skywalker, but his dark side.
Yeah.
You know, he's not a natural good guy. He's making a choice to do the right thing and doing his best to manage that. And that was a little different from what was the common run of fantasy in those days. You know, the common run of fantasy in those days was really the sort of Star Wars archetype, you know, the secret prince who discovers the prophecy that he's going to, you know, save the world from the Dark Lord. Most of it.
And then you have Kane, who just kind of revels in the dark side, I almost want to say. And you know, some of that is him and some of that is, you know, the studio heads going, you know, 2.6 lethal encounters per day.
Right.
Or you lose subscribers.
Right. Well, it's true. It's true. Imagine going to a James Bond movie where he doesn't kill anyone.
That's hard to imagine.
It is, isn't it? And you wouldn't like it very much because that's not what you go to James Bond movies for. I mean, I should say what you go to James Bond movies for is he gets to slaughter the bad guys and bang the hot chicks.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Well, that's the same reason that people like Kane. Because even though he's a bad guy himself by any sort of rational moral standard, the people he kills are almost always worse. And he does occasionally get to bang the hot chicks.
That is true. What sort of more did was this sort of a deliberately sort of throughout the story? I guess that's something we brought up was that Kane doesn't necessarily have an arc where he gains morality. Was that always intentional, or was it always about sort of this Ubermensch character arc instead?
Definitely the Ubermensch character arc. I mean, I have Duncan quote Nietzsche to Hari. You know, he quotes one of my favorite quotes from Nietzsche, which is whatever is done out of love takes place beyond good and evil. My kind of point of Kane is that he exists outside a conventional moral continuum because he's fighting for what he loves. That's in every case, in each of the four books, it's not always the same thing. In the first book, he's fighting to save his estranged wife. In the second, he's fighting to save the world that gave him a way out of the horror of his life on Earth, you know, and so on and so forth. But everything that Kane does, he does out of love and rage.
Those are pretty close together.
They are very close together. They feed into each other. When the rage comes, when what he loves is threatened, and the rage is more natural to him. I mean, I hope at any rate that people as they sort of continue exploring his biography through future books, see that, you know, he does actually grow, but not I wouldn't call it in a moral sense. He doesn't become a better person. What he does is manage to temper his rage, make it focus it so that he only destroys the people who need to be destroyed and doesn't hurt so many innocent bystanders.
And I would like to thank you now for vindicating my pronunciation throughout the episode, because I've always said Hari. I'm not sure where I picked that up. And
well, you would be right. You would be right. Hari is an epithet of Krishna. If you've ever been to a airport and seen the Hari Krishnas, you know, dancing and playing their tambourines and handing out books and stuff, that's what they say. It's Hari Hari, Hari Hari, Hari Krishna. But I should point out that everyone other than his father, who everybody else just calls him Harry. It's pronounced Hari, but everybody calls him Harry because they would.
Well, it's San Francisco.
Right. It's America, even if it's no longer the United States.
It's still America. It's still run by old white dudes.
Yep, sure is. Well, not all of them are white, and not all of them are dudes, but generally, yes.
And it's interesting, we were talking before we went live about how, you know, Harry is half Indian, but it's not never really a point in, it never comes up as a point in the fiction itself. And
it never comes up from an angle of bias or prejudice. It is a point in Blade of Tyshal. It's one of the ways that that Delian finds of approaching Kane to reference some of the Hindu mysticism that he could have gotten from, he could have in the metaphysics of the story sort of absorbed from his mother, who was Bengali, was also a Bengali anthropologist. So it's not that he was raised in that in a mystic tradition, but he was raised in a tradition of intellectual examination of mythic patterns, which has a lot to do with the general metaphysics of the entire series.
And does that Indian influence come in anywhere else in the setting?
It underlies the general metaphysics. There is a there's a theory of mind in that underlies the structure of the Acts of Cain. That is that I'm fairly certain I borrowed from Hindu mysticism. That it's sort of a variation of a pantheism in which there is actually only one consciousness, that everything, the entire universe, actually in the case of the book, all the universes, the multiverse, is a single thing, and individual consciousness arises through the interaction of a living nervous system with the universal consciousness. And so the way your nervous system is tuned by your experiences and your attitudes and your training, whatever, determines what part of the universal consciousness is expressed through what you experience as your consciousness, which, again, I think I probably cribbed out of the Vedas, but I couldn't be sure. I read a lot.
That's okay. It's all osmosis anyhow.
Something like it.
All right, so the front cover of this, at least my copy, I'm sure other people have the Orbit version, proclaims this to be a fantasy novel.
Right.
Was that your choice, or was that something the publisher did?
Nothing about the cover of Heroes Die was my choice. Nothing.
Okay.
I don't know anything about marketing books. And so Del Rey in those days did not offer authors. I mean, Heroes Die was my third novel, but it was my first book for Del Rey. And they did not offer new authors anything so exotic as cover approval. They just said, trust us, we'll make it look good and you'll sell a million copies. And not having any experience and really having to this day no evidence that anything I would have picked would have done better. It just is what it is. But no, it wasn't up to me. I mean, the a fantasy novel, the tagline on there was put on by the fantasy editor, the chief fantasy editor, Del Rey at that time, because she and the associate publisher were afraid that people would read the prologue and think it was a science fiction novel and then be confused later on the alternate world, magic works.
Okay.
That's how it was explained to me.
Okay. And
so they wanted to be sure that, because again, you know, in those days, they were trying to market me to, they were trying to fit me into the marketing vein of the Eddings and Terry Brooks, and maybe a little bit of, I flatter myself, Stephen Donaldson. Because I have some of Steve's literary aspirations, and I share his somewhat darker view of human nature than most of the fantasists who started working in the 80s and early 90s.
Well, the darker elements of human nature, those just go to orcs. It's okay to kill them.
Right. Yeah, except my orcs are different.
Well, everyone's orcs are different.
Well, I know, but I'm sorry. That's a it's an old there used to be a webcomic, I believe, called Our Elves Are Different.
Yeah. I believe so.
Yeah, but it's been, you know, I'm old, man. What do you want?
Well, I think TV Tropes has adopted it.
Oh, sure. As a matter of fact, Our Orcs Are Different is one of the tropes that they assigned to the Acts of Cain due to Orbeck and the Black Knives and Ogreloid in general. Ogrelay, which actually aren't orcs, but
Now that they're so different from orcs, you can't even they don't it doesn't even really apply.
well, I'm not sure. It depends on what you depends on what you're using an orc for. You know, I mean, orcs in the Hobbit, if I recall correctly, they didn't even have orcs. What they call orcs in the later books are in the Hobbit. They're the hill goblins, right? Or mountain goblins or something that are just
Yeah,
bigger,
they're
stronger
mountain goblins,
than the
yes.
regular goblins. The Ogrelay in the Acts of Cain are actually bred. They're the product of selective breeding of human beings. Just like we took wolves and turned them into all of these different breeds of dogs over 10,000 years. Well, over about the same amount of time, the first folk took humans and turned them into Ogrelay to be they are domesticated humans. So thus they don't have any of the like vulnerability to sunlight or any of the goblin related stuff. But they're, you know, that's us right there.
So they're at least a full challenge rating on their own, not a third.
Or something, yeah.
Something like
I don't
that.
I don't I'm not sure what a challenge rating is. It's been a little while since is that an RPG
Yeah, that's
thing?
D&D 3, third edition.
Okay.
Yeah,
Yeah,
I think.
I stopped playing at second edition, so
Okay.
I'm like I said, man, I'm old.
Okay. There we go. Something we commented on was the use of perspective in the novel, because you do play around a lot with that in your books, but
I
in
do.
this one we just started with Cain in Overworld is first person and everyone else is a limited third person. Was that how did that come about?
I wanted to evoke the feeling that I got when I used to read the best novels of Robert Heinlein and Roger Zelazny. The ones that always moved me the most were the ones in first person, because it really made me feel like I was experiencing the adventure inside the skin, inside the head of the hero. Now that there are a lot of limitations in the first person singular point of view, and in a relatively complicated universe like the one in which Heroes Die takes place, there's a lot of exposition that needs to be sort of sandwiched into the action. And there were also just a lot of things that, you know, sometimes you just have to be able to move away from the main character in order to make the plot make sense. And so I wanted to use the first person present tense, which it is, in fact, the first person present tense, to convey sort of the immediacy of what it would be like to be a first-hander for one of Cain's adventures, and then have the all of the rest of the book, well, actually not all of the rest of the book, but everything that is not a studio production in the book be in a more conventional third person limited sort of thing, so that I could get into the heads of the other characters and make sure that they are, you know, human, that they're it's important to me to have characters pursue their own agenda rather than simply serve a function of the plot. I mean, that's just good writing. And one of the ways that I would do that is sometimes I would write scenes. I would experiment with the point of view for particular scenes. And I would end up finally with the point of view that I thought made the scene the clearest, which is why sometimes you get things from, to use three examples of fairly major minor characters, Lamrak, Baron, and Toa Sytel, right? They all have scenes where they sort of interact in some ways with each other, or say Majesty is another good example. And sometimes in a scene with Toa Sytel and Baron, you see it from Toa Sytel's point of view, as in the early scene in Outside the Iron Room. And sometimes you see it from Baron's point of view. so that you also, in addition to helping to characterize them so that you understand the way they see the world, it also helps, I think, at least it was intended to help the reader understand what these people think of each other, which is not always easy to evoke it, unless it's something that's really, you know, obvious and blatant, without going into somebody else's point of view.
But it does sort of shed some light on why it seems like all the scenes in Alien Games are from, what's her name?
Kieran Dahl.
Yeah, Kieran Dahl's perspective, even though it's conversations with Kane.
Right. It's important. It was important to me to depict the way that other people's experiences of Kane, rather than just Kane's experiences of them, because I think it is far too easy to get caught up in the hero's point of view. I mean, from Kane's sort of internal framework, everything he does is the right thing to do, because in his world, right means protecting the people I love, full stop. For other people who may be in the way of him protecting people he loves, there's a little bit more nuance, you might say.
Yeah.
He's scary, and you know, I hope that comes across, that some people are afraid of him and think they can use him. Some people hate him and want him to die. So, you know, there is a range of reactions to him that is largely contingent upon the individual character's experience in interacting with him or the effects of things that he has done to other people.
Okay, and getting back to, I guess, the tone of the novel, which was very different at the time, but seems to be a bit prescient of where fantasy has gone, what with your George R. R. Martins and your Joe Abercrombies, and assorted
big,
others.
Big admirer of both of them, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
I'm slightly acquainted with Mr. Martin personally. I've been on a couple of panels with him, you know, years ago. Enjoy the books quite a bit. Abercrombie was one of the, I think he was recommended to me by Scott Lynch.
That sounds about right.
He said, "You know what, Matt? You need to read this guy because you like this stuff." And he was right. I do.
Yeah, I'm loving Abercrombie a lot. Oh,
sure.
Right now,
what's not to love?
What's not to love? But why were you sort of deliberately setting out against fantasy, or was it just this character demanded a lot of grim dark, and it's just a happy coincidence the genre has started to agree with you?
Happy coincidence might be a little bit of an overstatement. I did not set out to write anything grim and dark. I wanted to write something about someone the thing about Kane is that there is no line he will not cross. I mean, this is one of the most important definitions of the hero, you know, that there is some portion, no matter how otherwise anti-heroic or sociopathic or whatever they may appear to be, they have some code that they will not violate ever. Kane doesn't have that. Kane is, in fact, I think somebody made some comment to me once on an internet forum that Kane struck them as a guy who kind of exemplifies the ends justify the means. And I said, of course the ends justify the means. What could possibly justify any means except the results that you get by using them? That's not actually my personal point of view. My personal point of view is that if you have to justify something, you probably shouldn't do it in the first place. But Kane's point of view is whatever, I'll do whatever it takes. There is no line he will not cross to save his family or the world or whoever it is he has assigned his care to. There's nothing he won't do. And I thought that in and of itself was certainly in those days, an interesting, almost magical power, that the ability to be instantly ruthless. And yeah, that's kind of what I wanted to explore. I literally set out to write a novel about a bad guy, because I was tired of all of the, you know, Teflon princes and stainless steel princesses that dominated fantasy in those days. I like heroes like, say, for example, Thomas Covenant, who is in many ways a reprehensible individual, but who finds himself in a position where he has to step up and become more than anyone ever believed he could be. So that's what I wanted to do. I thought it would be interesting to write a novel about a bad guy and see if I could make people like him.
Well, I think it worked.
Well, thanks. Or I imagine we wouldn't be talking here 15 years later.
Yeah, probably not. And I guess with this tone and this character comes the violence. And yeah. I mean, obviously, this is a very, very violent novel. I think it does open with a knife through the eye.
Yep.
And at the same time, it does manage to come down as an actual critique of violent media at the same time. A little bit, another yeah. maybe perhaps prescient bit, considering how certain genres and certain media have gone.
Mm-hmm. So you saw what I did there.
I did see. I see what you did there. And it's still better than The Hunger Games.
Oh, thank you. I haven't actually read The Hunger Games, so I...
Well, every time someone says, oh, it's such a great critique of violence in media, I'm like, yeah, sure. It's pretty bloodless.
Yeah. Well, see, I suffer from a sort of cognitive dissonance in my own life. It has been my hobby for two-thirds of my life to practice ways of harming or killing people with my hands, or with blunt objects, or objects that are less than blunt. I like fighting. I like martial arts. I have been doing it for more than 30 years. There are very few things in my life I have done that are more fun than squaring off against somebody who's trying to knock my head off. It's just fun. It is a thrill that can't really be equaled by pretty much anything short of sex. So there's that on one side. I like violence. I respond to it emotionally. It's thrilling. At the same time, I'm not exactly a what would you call me? I'm not a savage. I'm not a barbarian. I'm actually rather well educated in the classics, and was raised by very, very liberal pacifist parents, both of whom, I might add, are veterans of World War II, but that's another story. So it's important to me. I feel a sort of moral obligation to not gloss over the consequences of violence, to not gloss over the horror and the blood and the bone splinters and the evacuation of bowels and bladder and all the rest, and also the lingering damage that being either a victim or a perpetrator inflicts on your life. But also, you know, I'm not the only person in the world who thinks violence is fun. I mean, that's why there are James Bond movies and Jackie Chan movies, and that's why there
have,
are...
Have you met Wesley Chu yet?
Wesley Chu?
He's a new author, but he's a kung fu master, and he just sort of finished up a career as a stuntman.
No kidding.
And I was listening to an interview with him, and it's like I think he was talking to the Writing Excuses guys, and he was talking about how much fun it is to, you know, get hit in the ribs really hard.
It is. It is. I'm telling you. Okay. Now I'm going to expose a little bit of my pretentious philosophy background. Robert Persig, the guy who wrote Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, also wrote another novel called Lila, and it has to do with dealing with madness. He himself, Persig, and his alter ego in the books suffered from major depression, bipolar disorder, in fact, for most of his life. And at one point, at least his character, Phaedrus, describes the experience of receiving electroshock. And he describes it as very much like being hit in the head with a bat. It fuzzes out your entire brain, reboots it, just like you're doing a hard reboot on your laptop. And he said, so what electroshock does is gives you the effect of being hit with a bat with a lot less physical trauma and long-term brain injury. Now, I've never been hit in the head with a bat, but I have been punched in the head by professional fighters. And it's very much the same thing. It can be embarrassing, especially if they tagged you because you did something stupid. It can be embarrassing, and it can, certainly at first, make you sort of want to curl up and put your hands up and, you know, try and look helpless, you know, like a puppy rolling over onto his back to submit, right? But it's also, I don't know, it's fun. I mean, it's certainly fun if you take it and you can keep fighting.
Getting back up is fun.
Back up is fun. Right. Getting knocked down sucks. Getting back up is awesome.
Yeah.
And I'm just saying, you know, I had this, do you know who R. Scott Baker is?
Yes.
Prince of Nothing, right?
Prince of Nothing, yeah.
He and I used to hang out on an internet forum back years ago before there was Facebook and such like stuff. And he was a graduate student in philosophy when he sold his first book, which I think was The Prince of Nothing. And he was struggling with nihilism.
Mm-hmm.
Which
like
is,
you know, do.
Yeah, like you do, especially if you are a thoughtful person of intellectual introspective bent, you start to wonder whether anything means anything. And I told him on the forum that I thought he should learn to box, because if he did, he would very shortly discover that not being punched in the face means something, that there is inherent meaning in being able to stop someone from punching you in the face. So I finally met him at a convention, World Fantasy Convention in Madison, Wisconsin. We were having a few drinks in the bar. And he started going on about how, you know, even my example of being punched in the face, I mean, you know, what's the point of seeking out meaning in violence? And I said, well, I'm not sure there is a point, but there's meaning there. And I said, give me your hand. And there's a, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but there's an actual pressure point on your
thumb hand. Thumb and forefinger, right?
Thumb and forefinger, right. And I just gave him a little pinch there.
Don't do that at home, kids.
Well, you do it to yourself.
do not pinch R. Scott Baker unless he asks you to.
Right. Don't do it to Scott, because he might hit you with something. Because I just got him because I caught him off guard and he didn't know what I was doing. So I gave that a little squeeze and he said, "Ow!" And he said, "What did that prove?" And I said, "See, there's meaning right there." And he said, "Oh, but that doesn't mean anything to the universe." And I said, "Yeah, but it meant something to you," which was, I think, the only time I have ever won an argument with an actual student of philosophy. So the upshot of all this is that it goes back to violence is fascinating. It's wonderful stuff. It is one of the main occupations of human beings. It has been entertainment for human beings ever since we were human beings, and possibly before. But at the same time, it's, you know, it's horrible. It's painful. It's dehumanizing, degrading, erodes the fabric of civilization. And so all I was trying to do was get both of those things in there. I wanted people to be attracted by the violence, even though when they stopped to think about it, they disapproved of it. Because I want them to disapprove, but I also want them to admit that they're attracted.
All right. So the one question we always ask whenever we review a book is who is the book for, and who would you say your book is for?
I actually had a very specific audience in mind when I wrote it, and that was people who felt they were outgrowing fantasy novels in those days. Because in those days, I mean, there were a few really fairly serious writers of fantasy for grown-ups. The obvious example, once again, I go back to Steve Donaldson. And there were some others, but they weren't that many. And I don't think any of them were as prominent or successful as Steve was. And a lot of people had come to think of the entire genre of fantasy as being secret princes and perky princesses and wisecracking dragons and, just not that there's anything wrong with
Wrong with that.
that. But there's just more. There's more there. There's more that can be done. I'm a student of the classics. I studied the Greek poets, especially, as anyone who's read me will realize, especially Homer. I've studied most of the sort of cultural mythic cycles that have made it into the larger mainstream. I mean, I don't know anything about like Basque mythology, or even if there is such a thing, but I know a bit about Spanish and three or four different Native American traditions and most of the other European traditions, a little bit of Russian, a little bit of, the South Asian and Chinese, Japanese, Korean, all that stuff. I know a little bit about this stuff. And it's all of our cultural history, the way our humanity is handed down to us from our ancestors in our culture is really through largely fantasy, fairy tales, magic, gods, elves, fairies, witches, vampires. And I just thought that somebody should try and get that going again. And while I certainly can't take credit for any of the rise of the more serious literary fantasies that have come along in the last 15 years, I must say I'm very grateful to see them. I'm very grateful to see people trying to use the elements of fantasy to do something more important than just sell books and make money.
Well, there we go. And so you just recently had these books re-released for, I suppose, ebooks for the PAL regions. And has there been any sort of response from that so far, or is it still just
Well,
quiet?
they are what they are. I mean, Orbit did a nice job formatting them up and did something that Del Rey had promised to do 3 books ago, which is tag them as being connected to each other, which is great. And they're getting good reviews from what I've seen. As to how they're selling, well, you'd have to ask my publisher. It's still a little early for that. I don't think I'll get my first royalty check till the spring.
That's great. And do we have anything more coming from this setting or Kane in particular?
Yes.
Can you say what?
No.
Okay.
Let me just put it this way. I'm wrapping up a book right now. I hope to be wrapping up a book right now, assuming those issues we were talking about off the air, non-professional related things calm down and I can actually wrap this up. I finish this. I have a tie-in to do, and then I have a open slate for my next fantasy series, and I have a variety of options, including two different takes. No, I'm sorry, three different, potentially different takes on the future of the Acts of Cain universe. Just that's about as much as I can say.
Those other two products you have coming up, can you say much about them yet?
Heroes Die, the narrative voice in Heroes Die comes out of hard-boiled detective novels. These were the other genre that I read growing up. I read science fiction and fantasy, and I read detective novels. And I particularly liked the hard-boiled detective novels, especially Raymond Chandler, which is where a lot of Kane's sort of narrative voice comes from, Philip Marlowe. So the last couple of years, in addition to some other projects, a couple of scripts I wrote for TV and the movies, that kind of thing. I thought, well, I've always kind of liked that hard-boiled detective voice. Why don't I just try and write something that's not science fiction or fantasy that has sort of what people would recognize, people who have read The Acts of Cain would recognize my sort of signature obsessions: violence, personal responsibility, identity, but set it in the modern world and have no magic or science fiction or technology. So that's what I'm trying to finish up right now, is something that would actually be outside the genre and probably, if it is published, won't be published under my name. But after that, well, like I said, there's a tie-in, which is still classified. And beyond that, I'm just going to be working on whatever is the most interesting thing that presents itself.
Cool, very cool. And I guess briefly, you've done a fair bit of tie-in fiction. What's been
Lots.
your oh yeah, a lot, but what's been your experience with that? Is it cool to just play in someone's sandbox, or is it just kind of a great thing to pay the bills with?
Well, it's both.
Okay.
But look, let me put it this way. I actually, somebody, I did an interview last year, earlier this year, something, where somebody asked me the same question. They were specifically asking me about Star Wars. But this applies to my other tie-in fiction as well. And what I said was, if you think about a book as a model made out of Legos, it's a lot easier to understand. If the Legos that you're making your model out of are your Legos, you can do whatever you want with them. You can saw them in half. You can glue them together. You can make any sort of shape your imagination can possibly summon. If, on the other hand, it's somebody else's Legos and they're paying you to do a specific type of model, then that's what you do. You take the Legos, you make the model. It's just as much work, sometimes more, because anybody who's serious about their craft wants to write well, wants to do anything they do well. So you take their Legos and you make their model, and if you're very good at this, you make it more beautiful, cooler, more engaging than they had imagined when they hired you to do it. But at the end of it, if they want to, they need to be able to take all their Legos back and get everything back in the box and in more or less their original condition.
And obviously working in tie-in exposes you to the fans of the property you're working for. How's that
Uh,
experience been for you?
um, I like it. I have upset a lot of Star Wars fans in my life, and now I have also upset some
You know
Magic
what? Star Wars
Gathering
fans are
fans.
kind of easy to upset.
Well, true. That's true. But the reason I like it is because even when they're upset, they're upset because they love the franchise. They have a proprietary feeling about the franchise, that it's important to them. It's part of their lives. And so in a number of cases, I can say, specific individual cases, people who are very, very angry with me for things I did in some of my Star Wars books, a couple of years later, when they got a little distance from it, all of a sudden they realized that they really, really liked the books that made that previously made them angry. Now, obviously not everybody. There are still some people who've never forgiven me. But thank God, at least I'm not the guy who killed Chewbacca.
Oh, yeah. No, no one
'Cause
wanted to be that guy.
nobody wanted. Bob got death threats.
Oh no, I believe that.
He did. I got this. I got this from him. He got death threats on the internet.
Hey, and death, you know what? I'm gonna throw this out there. Death threats on the internet are actually a measure of success.
Well, it is a compliment. I mean, no one has ever threatened me with death on the internet. I've had a couple of people threaten to come up to me at an author signing and stab me, but that's just because they thought it would be funny if I beat the crap out of them. So
Wait,
no,
wait. Well,
I've
that's
got.
even flattering that it's like, well, if I stabbed you, you'd still be able to beat me up.
Yes. They actually a couple of these guys are still. I still correspond with them, which I think is kind of funny. But yeah, one of them came up to me at a signing for Revenge of the Sith. So now 8 years ago, and shook my hand. And said, oh, by the way, I'm the guy who said he was going to shank you, and I had a hold of his hand. I'm like, okay. And he said, no, I was just trying to get your attention, man. That's all.
That'll do it.
Yeah, well, I'm not too worried about it, to tell you the truth. I know you don't. You we're not doing this on video, but I'm a very, very large person, and somebody using an improvised blade would have to be really good at it to do me serious harm across a table at in a bookstore filled with other people who would, jump him if they saw him come at me with a knife. I'm not too worried about it. Now, somebody wanted to shoot me, well, I would take that more seriously.
Yeah. So I guess we're winding down a little,
Sure.
but is there anywhere people should go to find you on the internet? Do you have a blog or something like that?
Just Facebook.
Okay.
Yeah, my author page, Matthew Woodring Stover, on Facebook. I had a blog for a long time, but I just gave it up because there are only so many words prepared to come out of me on any given day, and I prefer to put them into books where I will get paid for them.
That's a good plan. That strikes me as.
Well, it's not even a plan. It's actually just who I am.
Okay.
Let me put it this way. One of my favorite writers working currently is John Scalzi.
Right.
I love this guy's work. Loved it. I read his first novel and I wrote him, I basically wrote him a love letter. I was like, I can't believe how good this book is. And, and I check in on his blog every couple of days. And then the guy just, it's unbelievable the amount of content he generates on that blog, plus bringing out a book pretty much every year. I wish I was that kind of person, but I am unfortunately who I am.
That's true. And I guess one last thing, because I like to ask this. So it's November, and there are people out there writing novels this month. What do you think of this whole weird endeavor of people just writing novels and not doing anything?
NaNoWriMo.
NaNoWriMo.
Yeah, I think it's great. I do. I think I. Let me put it this way. Previously, especially when I was near my peak ascendance as an author of Star Wars, which really gave me more exposure than anything else I've ever done. I mean, Revenge of the Sith was basically translated into every language spoken by more than 12 people. And I would get a lot of fan mail and or attention on the internet and stuff like that. People would ask me, what they should do to become a writer. And I would say, well, write. If you write, you're a writer. If you don't write, you're not a writer. Having written does not count. Even if you've, sold 12 books, if you're not writing, you're not a writer. And if you are, you are. And it doesn't matter whether you sell it or not. So this goes back to NaNoWriMo. It's not how I go about writing books. And in fact, I couldn't do it if I wanted to. I'm just not, it's not the way my brain works. But I think it's great because I think that I know, in fact, that people have gotten excited by it and they start writing and they discover, hey, you know what? I can do this. And then there's another writer in the world. As I've been telling people for, Christ, decades now, good writers are never in competition with each other. The only competition for good writers is bad writers. Because bad writers make people think that books aren't important and that they don't need to read and that reading doesn't have anything to really offer them. I used to get a lot of fan mail from parents, in fact, telling me how their kids have gotten excited about reading, especially, my Star Wars books. And I say, well, that's what it is. People who don't like to read just never read the right book. They just never found the right book. And I'm not saying my books are right for everybody. Obviously, they're not. God forbid. But there is a good book, or more than one. There are good books out there for every taste. So good writers make people want to read more. And so it's always in our interest to encourage good writers. And again, I think I got back around to the trailhead there, and that made sense, but I'm not sure.
I think it all worked out. Well, thank you very much for coming out this
It's my
evening.
pleasure. It's my
And
pleasure. I hope you edit this carefully.
oh, I will. I will. This probably won't be one of those. I'll just truncate the silence and skip every 5 seconds. It'll work out.
Okay. Yeah, whatever.
But yeah, thanks. And thank you all for listening. Have a good night.
Backseat Book Club is a Backseat production. Visit backseatproducers.com for more shows. Join the discussion and make suggestions for books on goodreads.com. Music by Kevin MacLeod.